Maine food traditions and Thanksgiving tips. Thanksgiving is the most food-centric of holidays. Most of us are focused on turkey and pie this time of year, and we'll talk about these staples. But today on Maine Calling, we're also going to talk about the different dishes and traditions that have become part of how people in Maine celebrate special occasions. We'll discuss Maine food traditions, from Native American stews to French Canadian meat pies, and how holiday foods stem from the deep connection to land and sea that we've always had in our state. We'll also learn about the new Maine Bicentennial Cookbook Project, which will pull together favorite family recipes from all across the state. And our panel of culinary experts will offer tips and advice on Thanksgiving recipes. Which dishes do you associate with special holiday meals? I'm Cindy Hahn. Maine food traditions are next on Maine Calling, but first, this news update. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Cindy Hahn, and this is Maine Calling. Yes, tomorrow is Thanksgiving, and for many of us, that means getting the turkey and side dishes ready for a big feast. Today, we're going to talk about some traditional holiday foods and get some last-minute suggestions on what to make. But we'll also talk about some other Maine food traditions, and we want to hear about your favorite dishes and family recipes. Joining me in the studio is our panel of culinary experts, Nancy Harmon Jenkins. She is food journalist, historian, writer, speaker, and cookbook author. Peggy Krudinski is the food, books, and outdoors editor for the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram. And Sam Hayward is the chef owner of 4th Street Restaurant. He's known for being a pioneer in the farm-to-table movement. As always, we'd like to hear from you. What holiday food traditions do you celebrate? Do you have any favorite childhood dishes? Need any advice from our panel of food experts? Our phone number is 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post a comment to the Facebook page. And thank you all for being here today. It's so good to have you on this day before Thanksgiving. It's a day tomorrow centered around tradition, and many people stick to the usual Thanksgiving dishes. But what do each of you do for Thanksgiving? Is it turkey and stuffing and all of that, or do you do something different? Peggy, why don't we start with you?
I'm actually not hosting this year. I'm going to someone else's house, and I know she's having turkey, but also a ham because she needs my refrigerator to put the ham in.
So, that's the biggest challenge of Thanksgiving.
Yes, exactly. I would say I hosted a couple years ago. I have a sister who is kind of a aspiring vegetarian. And so we had this really beautiful lasagna with chestnuts and I think it was either kale or Swiss chard and then butternut squash. And that was wonderful.
That's interesting. I was going to talk about that later, but the vegan and vegetarian sort of dishes that you can make for Thanksgiving, I know that there are plenty of options still. So hopefully I know some of our listeners will call in with some suggestions for that. How about you, Nancy? How does your Thanksgiving look?
Oh, it looks extremely traditional because we have a 12-year-old in the house who is insisting on turkey. If it weren't for Nadir, we would not be having turkey, I can assure you, because I really don't like turkey at
Ooh.
All. Nor does anybody else in my family. We, when we lived in Italy, we always had this is going to sound terribly aspirational, but we always had a boned loin of pork that was roasted on a spit and turned in front of the wood fire in the living room and basted with red wine throughout the course of the day. And that was, to me, a very celebratory meal. But I think, being in Maine, one of the things that I think we should start all these wintertime feasts off with is some kind of a stew made from our great seafood, a lobster stew, or nowadays that oysters are so much more around than they used to be, an oyster stew. It's a wonderful way to start off that feast. And that's what I'm hoping to do tomorrow with lobster.
Well, isn't chowder a traditional holiday kind of food here in Maine?
I think chowder more is an everyday dish, you know, although it would be perfectly. I mean, I don't see any reason why we have to invent dishes. I think that's one reason why cooks get into such anxiety and stress over the holiday, because they're cooking something they're not used to cook. Instead of a turkey, why not put four chickens in the oven at once? And they'll be done in much less time with much less anxiety and stress and frustration over them. And they'll taste even more delicious. You could put a different seasoning on each one of them.
Oh, that's a great idea. So all of you anti-turkey folks, listen to Nancy. She has great ideas. Actually, I want to just follow up because you said when you were in Italy, you celebrated. This was just you carrying on your own American tradition.
Many people have asked me how Italians celebrate Thanksgiving. And I have to say, actually, they don't.
Okay.
It's an American holiday. Even our cousins in Canada don't celebrate Thanksgiving on the same day we do.
They do it earlier.
They have it in October, yeah.
And that's because the harvest is earlier, I assume.
Well, you would assume that. But, you know, nowadays we have harvests that go on all year round practically.
Oh, that's true.
But it is, you know, it's the closing down of the season basically is what less the harvest than the fact that the season has come to a close and it's time to rest a bit before we start up again.
But
so
also,
that's really what it's about.
I'm thinking that my mother is Canadian, and Canadian Thanksgiving is just not a big holiday the way it is here.
Oh.
When my mother married an American, and that's how she ended up here, but she had never celebrated Thanksgiving. It really is not. It's a very it's just not much of a holiday there. Not the way it is here.
Huh. And Sam, something tells me you don't do a totally traditional Thanksgiving. Is that true?
Well, I'd have to say I'm sunk in tradition this time around. We are doing turkey. We almost always do turkeys because we were raising kids, and that's one of those things that binds generations together, and I think they always really loved it. And it's a dramatic presentation. But we do it in a wood-burning oven. I usually do a dry brine overnight before I put it in the oven. And I think it's a pretty good dish. It's the only time in the year that I ever cook a turkey. It's just not something that I gravitate toward. And I'm not that fond of it. But it's all what we do with it. And I completely agree with my colleagues that what would be really fun would be to center a Thanksgiving feast around seafood. And if we think about the traditions, if Thanksgiving is a way of sort of connecting romantically with the pilgrim mythology and the origins of New England and America, then we should be thinking about the kinds of seafood that the pilgrims themselves in Plymouth were salivating for. Eels. Other seafood.
So you're not even talking about lobster.
No. Right. Although I think starting a Thanksgiving feast with chilled oysters on the half shell, not to mention the deliciousness of an oyster stew would be fantastic. But I keep thinking, I want to introduce other things that, if we're going to romanticize that tradition anyway, why not get something that's really kind of interesting?
Well, it's funny that you mention eels because the whole elver fishing that's right. So successful here, but then we send them off to Asia.
Somewhere else.
But people are starting to talk about how to prepare eel. So how would you prepare eel?
Well, there are tons of different ways, and I would have to say I need more experience before I'd advise anybody else on how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But typically what we've done at 4th Street when we can get our hands on them is to do them in some kind of a roast or pan fry or even poached. We've smoked them. We've done all kinds of things with them for special events, one which we did with Nancy a few years back up at the Searsport Maritime Museum, which was really fun.
Penobscot Museum, I think it's called.
Penobscot Marine Museum. It was really, really a lot of fun. And we were able to get those from a supplier and a grower here in Maine who was taking Maine elvers and raising them out for adult eels. And they're really very good.
Well, I have to say I've eaten my share of eel, and I love it. So, you know, for anyone who's thinking of it, don't be afraid. but let's stick with Thanksgiving a little longer. What about side dishes? Other than the turkey, is there any outstanding favorite side dish that you prepare or that you would recommend people trying to make?
I'm going to make a gratin dauphinois of Maine potatoes.
Okay, you made that sound scary.
It's not scary at all. You slice the potatoes very thinly. You layer them with butter and a little onion and some warm cream and maybe some warm chicken stock or some kind of stock. And you put them in the oven and you bake them until they're tender and also until they're crispy and brown on the top. And it's so much nicer than mashed potatoes.
Mm.
I really hated, the other thing I hated about Thanksgiving was all those mashed vegetables. My mother would always serve mashed turnips and mashed squash and onions that had the bejesus boiled out of them. And it was just such uninteresting food to me. I couldn't stand it. Besides, there were no presents.
I take it you didn't have the the kind of mushy green beans with the mushroom soup.
No, that came along much later. I'm a lot older than most of the people
trend.
In this
okay.
room, and a lot older than that horrible green bean casserole. Though I was thinking, you know, if you took fresh green beans and you made a kind of light bechamel with some nice foraged mushrooms in it, and you sizzled some onions and put them on top, that's not a bad dish.
Yeah, that's the same idea, just not as mushy, right?
Yeah.
And Peggy, you went to the trouble of actually bringing something for us to try today. Tell us what you brought in.
Well, it's not a side dish.
It's beautiful.
It's a salted caramel cranberry tart. Because I've been in sort of a state, I have to bring a dessert to the Thanksgiving I'm going to, and I've been in a state of indecision and can't make up my mind between about six desserts, and I keep going back and forth. So this morning I thought, well, I'll just make one and see what I think.
So we benefited from your experiment. We're going to taste that in a second. It looks beautiful.
May I say something about side dishes for
sure,
a moment?
Sure, yes.
I don't know if this is other people's experience, but I'm often going somewhere and bringing something, and the meal is often lots of different things that people are bringing. And I feel like it ends up being sort of, as Nancy said, often, the meal might be somewhat mushy, or it might feel very kind of bland and nursery food-like and filling. And so I like side dishes that have something surprising, like a pickled onion or some sort of sour element. Last year, I went to a Thanksgiving where someone made Brussels sprouts and put a sauce over them that had chilies and lime and fish sauce. And it just felt very lively.
Mm. Something a little bolder.
Yeah. So I suggest that for people who are going to very traditional Thanksgivings, that it's fun to you know, stick lemongrass in with your squash or just do something a little lively.
Bring acidic foods, which is in contrast to the sort of dull, heavy, darker flavors of a traditional Thanksgiving and all that mash stuff. Give me a great pickle dish.
What would you pickle,
really what,
Sam?
Well, we have our chef at 4th Street is now embarking on a continuation of a longstanding habit that we have there of pickling the summer's bounty, and he does everything. So we have amazing quick pickles of things like different radishes, different root vegetables, cucumbers of different sizes, shapes, and textures. It's been really a great year to see the experimentation from summer bounty to winter inclusion. It's going to be terrific.
And in some way, I remember when you used to go to very, very old-fashioned sort of New England restaurants and they would bring you a relish wheel with all kinds of... So in some way, that sort of sour pickled element actually has a strong element of tradition. And
I think it's deeply traditional. I think one of the reasons why New Englanders were able to sustain this bland, mushy diet all winter long was because they had pickles to go with it.
Right.
Huh.
And I don't know whether the pickles added any kind of nutritional element to it, but they certainly added an aesthetic element. They were bright on the plate as opposed to the pale vegetables, and the intensity of their flavors were... I mean, most of those old cookbooks that you look at, and I know Don Lindgren is going to talk
about
that later.
He's about to join us, yes.
But most of those old cookbooks have masses of recipes for pickling in them. And usually it's not fermenting, although I think fermenting has become much more interesting these days, but just straightforward pickling in salt and brine and vinegar.
Right.
And you can really do it with anything. I pickled some grapes, and I'll throw them into the salad I'm making for tomorrow.
Well, Nancy, you mentioned Don, and sure enough, joining us on the line now is Don Lindgren. He is an antiquarian bookseller and the owner of Rabelais, Inc., Fine Books on Food and Drink, and he's a team member of the upcoming Maine Bicentennial Community Cookbook. Thanks for calling in, Don.
Oh, thanks. It's great to be here, and it's great to hear all of these voices that I care for so much. Thank you.
Right, and I know you have an extensive knowledge of the old Maine cookbooks, and you've seen many time-honored recipes. Can you share an example of any traditional Maine dish that's been around since centuries ago?
Well, my interest really started because I was looking at Maine printed cookbooks, and I was looking to see what did they tell us about the traditions of Maine. And like so many other printed cookbooks, they would borrow from everywhere. So it's really about what worked for different people at different moments. I won't say I have a favorite recipe. I try things pretty frequently, and I do find that my own personal tastes run to sort of more slightly more modern flavor profiles. Like I like things a little punchier than they might be. But I have learned over the years that paying more attention to the ingredients, like using apples that are, you know, really good, tasty apples that, you know, I would know nothing about if it weren't for people like John Bunker, is going to make all the difference when I make something that has apples in it. So it's to me, it's about sort of like reconnecting with ingredients through a recipe.
Great. And I understand you're involved with this Maine Bicentennial Cookbook Project, and you're collecting recipes from all over Maine. Can you tell us more about what you're doing?
Absolutely. The project was initiated by Carl Schatz and Margaret Hathaway, that you may know from a number of different books. They've done a Food Lover's Guide to Maine and the New Portland Maine Chef's Table. There are goat farmers who live in Gray and have 10 apple farm. And they've been friends of mine since we moved up here. The project is basically a community cookbook to celebrate the bicentennial of Maine, which is, of course, next year. And community cookbooks are a special genre. And in Maine, they're important because most of the books produced in Maine that are food books, that are cookbooks, are community books. And this one, the community will be the entire state of Maine. The idea is to reach out to people and just ask them to share their recipes. They don't have to be historical. They don't need to be traditional Maine recipes. They just need to be the recipes that they like cooking, things that they like eating all over the state. And the real emphasis is on ordinary folks all over the state, in every corner, in every town, farmers and fishermen, you know, hipsters and hockey moms. It's like the whole range of things.
Well, we have three folks right sitting in front of me you should tap into for some great recipes.
But absolutely, and we will.
And do you want to talk about how people go about sending in those recipes?
Sure. There are two things. We're looking for recipes, and we're also looking for your photographs or reminiscences. And if they go to the website, which is Maine200cookbook.com, that's Maine200cookbook with the 200 is the number, 200cookbook.com, and all the information they need to know is there. They can submit photographs or recipes right there. They can give all their information. We'll be selecting obviously there's going to be an issue if we get 43 different blueberry cakes, then we'll need to select, but we're going to try to honor all of the ones we receive. And also at that website, Maine200cookbook.com, there's a link over to the Kickstarter campaign that will support the cost of printing and design and such. And those are two things that make community cookbooks what they are. You know, that we use these modern words, crowdsourcing and crowdfunding, but that's what these communities of women in, predominantly women, in churches and Grange halls and firemen's auxiliaries and hospital groups were crowdfunding to raise money to produce the book, and then they were crowdsourcing all the recipes from within their community. And we're going to honor that tradition with this project.
Well, that sounds great. And I know Maine Public is involved with that as we celebrate the bicentennial as well. So we've got some information about that on our Facebook page and on our website. And hopefully people will send in those favorite recipes. So thank you for joining us, Don. Don Lindgren is with Rabelais, Inc., and he's also helping to organize the Maine Bicentennial Community Cookbook. Thank you, Don. Did you have some comments about that, the concept of a community cookbook?
I'm just thinking, Don, that often when you look at them, and you know so much more than I do about this, but they do have 43 blueberry cake recipes, yes. And often they're the same recipes, just put in 12 times, and, you know, very heavy on desserts, often community cookbooks. So mm-hmm. I'd say maybe go for it if you get 43.
We'll see what comes in for that.
Well, I wonder if they're going to have 200 recipes or... for each year.
Yeah, I wonder how that'll work. We need to take a quick break right now, but we'll be right back, and we'll take your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Damariscotta River Grill, celebrating 16 years of serving grown-up comfort food. Open year-round on Main Street in Damariscotta. DamariscottaRiverGrill.com. AARP Maine, working to lower prescription drug costs. Learn more at aarp.org/rx. And Bull Moose, celebrating the tactile experience of reading and proponents of dog ears and bookmarks. Locations across Maine and at bullmoose.com.
Mandy Patinkin's been on a performing streak since he was a teenager.
I did a play. Something happened in rehearsal one day, and I thought, this sounds good. And I did that for more than 40 years.
Along the way, Broadway musicals, The Princess Bride, Homeland, but now?
I want to be lost. I want to see what I bump into.
What's next for Mandy Patinkin this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News?
That's this afternoon between 4 and 6:30 here on Maine Public Radio. For those of you who might be in the mood to get into the holiday spirit on the early side this year, perhaps around Thanksgiving, our much-appreciated Maine Public Classical Holiday Stream is once again up and running. Christmas, Solstice, Advent, Hanukkah, music of the season, just about nonstop, made possible for you, by you. Thanks for your support. You can find the Holiday Stream in its usual place as one of the streaming choices on the Maine Public app or at our website, mainepublic.org. When you get there, click on the Listen link right under the picture at the top. And when you do that, you'll see all the choices available. Maine Public Radio, Classical, and now the Holiday Stream. Enjoy.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Cindy Hahn. Today on the program, food, food, and more food. We're talking about Thanksgiving recipes, traditional Maine dishes, and family favorites. Joining me in the studio, Peggy Gradinsky, food books and outdoors editor for the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram, Sam Hayward, chef owner of 4th Street and a James Beard award-winning chef, and Nancy Harmon Jenkins, all-around food expert, journalist, speaker, and historian. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. You can also check out Instagram. We've got a picture on there of this fabulous tart pie cranberry creation that Peggy brought in, which I'm still chewing right now. We all just tasted. Any comments from the other panelists?
It's fantastic. It's really good. It was wonderful.
So this is what you mentioned, bringing something that has a bit of zing to it, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So what is it that's so tart besides the cranberries?
Probably the cranberries, but it's basically just caramel, which is taking sugar in and cooking it. So you can cook sugar dry. That's a little trickier. I don't know if people who are listening to us have made caramel before. I find that a little bit, you need a little more nerve to do it that way. And you can also add a little liquid to the sugar when you put it on a pan on the stove, turn it into kind of a wet sand texture, and then cook it that way until the sugar gets brown. And that one is a little bit less frightening. You have a little more control to keep the sugar from burning. And in this case, instead of using water for the liquid, I used fresh orange juice zest.
You
so
do taste that.
That might be what you're tasting. Yeah.
Well, terrific. Well, calling in now is John Bear Mitchell. He's a citizen of the Penobscot Nation from Indian Island, and he coordinates the University of Maine's Wabanaki Outreach and Student Development, and he also lectures on Wabanaki and Multicultural Studies. Thank you for joining us, John.
Thanks for having me.
So we, the panelists and I were actually talking earlier about how the story of the first Thanksgiving that was taught to so many of us in elementary school is kind of an idealized version where pilgrims and Native Americans came together for a communal meal to celebrate the harvest. So that historical accuracy, I guess, has been sort of debunked over the years. But there is truth to the idea that many of the dishes that we eat for Thanksgiving do have roots in Native American foods. Is that right?
Most certainly. Even the turkey that nobody likes.
we all like it.
Yeah, it's good in certain ways, but at the same time, it was absolutely not even present at the any of those types of events. Simply because any kind of poultry like that was killed had to be eaten immediately. You couldn't really preserve it. We had no chemicals to do that or any process in which we could preserve that and make it palatable down the road. So it was something that was, if it was taken, it was eaten immediately. So it wasn't part of that process at all, and simply for that reason.
Sam Hayward mentioned earlier, he read that they mentioned fowl in one of the historic descriptions of this type of meal that might have occurred. Do you know what fowl that might have been?
Yeah, mostly what it was ducks or ocean birds. Yep. And those types of things were they're a little more apt to last a little bit longer, and especially if it's warm. Again, they have to be eaten immediately, but most of the fowl that was eaten at that time was ducks and ocean types of birds.
Hmm. And you grew up with certain tribal traditions. Can you just tell us about any of those dishes that reflect your heritage and whether you just eat them for special occasions or everyday kind of family favorites?
Excellent question. We had several Thanksgivings a year, if you want to call them that. We had several different feasts that happened at different times during different types of harvests. And immediately it was sort of like this celebration of these foods becoming available again in their fresh state. But when I was growing up, and I did a little bit of a survey knowing ahead of time that I was going to be part of this with some other people that I know in some of the other tribes of Maine, and I come up with maybe three really interesting types of foods that people remember growing up with that still are eaten at Thanksgiving, but I guess it's like a hunter-gatherer type of meal if you really look at it. Something that people would eat year-round as well, but definitely became part of a bigger feast for what we call now Thanksgiving, which mostly is a family holiday. I don't think anybody sits down and really, prays and remembers pilgrims and necessarily or Indians, but even what I hear being prepared by the folks who are present at the studio are foods that are indigenous to this land.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a lot of food that was that's being used in very creative ways, and I can only imagine that myself and many other Native people appreciate the way they put together now, because back in the day they were probably what we would consider today probably bland, but provided us with the nutrition that we needed. So one of the most interesting things, two things that I think I haven't heard, and I don't think I'll hear from your guests or even from people who call in, is muskrat and potatoes.
Ooh.
Which was boiled. And this time of year, there's a lot of trapping, and muskrat are definitely something that's trapped by the hundreds before their pelts. And growing up, I had grown up with muskrat and potatoes.
What does it taste like?
So, you haven't driven by a bog in the summertime in the evening, and that sweet smell.
That smell.
That smell is exactly how they taste.
Huh. In a good way.
in a good way. Now, you do have to boil them a couple times and change the water, because they can be overwhelmingly sweet and rancid almost, because it's almost like a rotting root type of smell. But I don't want to say that in a real negative way. Again, it's something that we definitely partook in.
So usually as a stew or a soup? Or
absolutely. It's always boiled. You would never do it any other way.
Huh.
I saw it fried once, and I could only sit back and watch people eat it and make a certain face that probably they picked up on.
What about raccoons, John? I've heard of raccoons having the same kind of treatment, where you would boil them in several changes of water to get rid of, they say to get rid of the fat, because I guess the fat is where the rancidity is.
Yeah, raccoon is definitely a lot different in the fat, where the muskrat has none. But it's same thing with a porcupine too. It's similar in that you don't boil a porcupine. Traditionally, they were just thrown into a fire hole with the quills and all on.
Oh.
And and then the meat was picked off after it was cooked. But I definitely remember growing up with, and I can honestly tell you, I've not eaten a porcupine. I have not eaten a raccoon.
Oh, darn. I was going to have you compare the three.
Yeah. But muskrat and potatoes are pretty good. And they definitely are boiled. And the last thing you put in is some onions and potatoes within the muskrat. And you boil it with bone on it. And so
well, great.
The other one, if I can quickly mention, that I remember eating, and my grandmother always talked about this too, was porpoise stew.
Wow.
And the porpoise stew was something that is still served. And again, it's not just served during the winter months, which tastes really good, but they hunted the porpoise in the warmer months, obviously. And then they would fry the porpoise skin, which sort of is reminiscent of a fatback. Mm-hmm. It gives off that, a lot of that grease and that oil, which was then used for other purposes as well, lighting small lamps or even cooking oil. But porpoise stew, porpoise has a consistency of almost like pork. Mm-hmm. It's almost like organ meat. You can't really fry it as steaks. It kind of pulls itself apart as it's cooking into small round chunks. And so the only way you could really do that is stews. We ate a lot of stew apparently. And those two things come up as something really different than what I'm hearing, as something that was traditional. It's stuff I've eaten too growing up, but definitely stuff that's still served to this day.
Well, that's so fascinating. Wow. Thank you for calling, John. John Bear Mitchell is a citizen of the Penobscot Nation. He teaches Wabanaki studies at the University of Maine. And we have, I think, a lot of people calling with their own cultural traditions that they want to talk about. So we'll go to Tom calling from Portland. Hi, Tom.
Hi, how are you?
Good. How are you? What did you want to talk about?
Well, this is an event that runs between Thanksgiving and Christmas. So it isn't exactly Thanksgiving.
Oh, that's fine. Anything's good.
Okay. Santa Lucia is celebrated. Yes. Her date is actually December 13th. But Saturday, the 7th, at St. Ansgar Lutheran Church in the Belmont, in the Deering area, there's a fair, Scandinavian fair, 10 to 2. And there are four items that I want to just throw out for people to listen about. One of them is called Lucia Buns, Lucibulla, which is a sweet bread with saffron and nutmeg and cinnamon that people love. And then there's a julekaka, a Swedish Christmas bread, famous for the cardamom flavor. And then Danish rye bread will be available. It's a very dense Baltic-style rye bread you would only use with open-faced sandwiches. And then Danish æbleskiver. So Santa Lucia, Scandinavian fair at St. Ansgar this coming Saturday. And then the following day, we actually observe Santa Lucia with a pageant at 4 o'clock. It comes from a tradition in Scandinavia where the oldest daughter in a family on the 13th goes around early in the morning when people are still in bed and wakes them up with coffee and with the Lucia buns. And she wears a crown of 7 candles in her hair. So that tradition will be carried on Sunday afternoon.
Well, thank you, Tom. Thanks for sharing all that. If you get a chance to post any of that on our Facebook page, that would be terrific. But another tradition, have you all tried or heard of all of those different Scandinavian foods?
Yes. Some of the breads, yeah.
Yeah.
There's a very large Scandinavian community historically in Maine, and I think it's marvelous that these things are perpetuated. You know, it's an interesting thing about immigration. You come to another country, you bring with it your food traditions, you kind of integrate everything in together very smoothly, but then there are these things that continue to be yours and are celebrated usually one day a year or maybe on birthdays and things like that. I love that idea.
But what struck me too is, you know, it is such an old Maine tradition because there is a long-standing Scandinavian population here. But interestingly, so many of these things that he mentioned are now very trendy. Cardamom and rye and saffron are all having their moment. Rye is now grown in Maine by Maine Grains, I think, is growing some rye. Somebody correct me if I'm wrong on that. And saffron, I think I've heard that there's Amish farmers up in the county that are growing saffron here. So it's interesting to me that it's, you know, to sound like an old guide, your badly written guidebook, it's old yet new.
Right.
Well, saffron was actually grown by Martha Ballard back in the early 19th century in Hollowell or Augusta now, and I've grown it myself. It's really fun.
I'm going to go to Tim, even though he's got, I think, a similar thing to talk about. But, Tim, we wanted to hear from you, too, calling from Waterville.
Hi, Cindy. Hi, guests. How are you?
Good. Hi. What did you want to share with us?
So I know much of those things Tom was just talking about because I'm in Waterville, but I was born and raised in Aroostook County in New Sweden. which is the hotbed of the Swedish communities up there, of New Sweden, Stockholm, Jämtland, Westmanland. And so one of the things I remember that we always had, you know, between Thanksgiving and Christmas or New Year's, anytime there was a family event or a church dinner or something, there'd always be a big platter of what we knew as Spritz cookies.
Oh.
And Spritz cookies are made with a cookie press, and they're like a shortbread or butter cookie, and they generally would be pressed out of the cookie press, and depending on what little stencil they may use, they would have little ridges on the dough, and then it would be formed into a circle. And then they'd be baked, and my late mother had a great recipe for it, but Mom, please, you know, I apologize, but I think my Aunt Geneva had the better. I think they have used a different type of butter, you know. I was always glad to see that Aunt Geneva was coming to the family gathering.
She's got the good cookies. Well, have you know that Sam was just pantomiming making those, so I think he knows exactly.
No, my mother had a cookie press when growing up, but it was it looked like a small sausage stuffer with a turn handle
as
on it.
As did mine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was great. I loved them.
And better we used than to Play-Doh, right?
Little maraschino cherries to decorate them. Yeah. Did you
I
do that as well?
I loved Spritz cookies as a kid.
You got to get them from Tim's aunt, yeah. Right?
Well, that would be a really good recipe to go in the 200 years
good
of Maine
idea,
cooking,
Nancy,
wouldn't it?
That's yeah,
a great
so
idea.
Hopefully that'll make it in there. Thank you for calling, Tim. And we do need to go to another quick break, but when we come back, more of your questions and comments. You're listening to Maine Calling. We will be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Maine Masonic Charitable Foundation, supporting Maine Public Radio's efforts to provide knowledge, wisdom, and entertainment to the people of Maine. Andrucki and King, representing clients in all areas of family law, civil litigation, and criminal defense in state and federal courts. AndruckiLaw.com. And Breakwater Curiosity for Life, offering exceptional day school and after-school options for toddlers through 8th grade. BreakwaterLearning.org.
Coming up on the next Commonwealth Club program, carbon offsets are used by many people around the world to alleviate the environmental impacts of their lifestyles. Join us for a conversation with activists for insight into how carbon offsets are supposed to work, how they work in actual practice, and some of the unintended consequences of relying on carbon offsets to slow climate change. On the next Commonwealth Club radio program.
That's this afternoon at 2 here on Maine Public Radio. And it's Wednesday, so that means Science Night on Maine Public Television. And at 10, a special report from the News Hour, The Plastic Problem. By 2050, there will be more plastic than fish in the oceans. PBS News Hour takes a closer look at this now ubiquitous material, how it's impacting the world, and ways we can break our plastic addiction. That's tonight at 10, with a rebroadcast Sunday afternoon at 5.
Welcome back. I'm Cindy Hahn, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, Maine food traditions and favorite holiday dishes. Joining me, Sam Hayward, James Beard Award-winning chef and owner of 4th Street Restaurant, Nancy Harmon Jenkins, food journalist, historian, cookbook author, and speaker, and Peggy Gradinsky, food editor with the Portland Press Herald. Join our conversation and give us a call. Our number is 1-800-399-3566. And joining us on the line here, if I can click the button, is Shoshana Hose. She is with Welcoming the Stranger, and she led a Thanksgiving event for New Mainers. Hi, Shoshana. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you. It's nice to be part of this program.
So tell us about, it was a Thanksgiving meal that you helped organize for people who are new to Maine.
That's correct. We are an effort in the Portland area to match asylum seekers with local people who mentor them and help them acclimate to life in the area. And every year we get all the people involved in our program together for a big Thanksgiving dinner. So we had that on Sunday this year.
So some of the new folks who just arrived, the whole large group who came here this summer, were able to go to that?
There were some new people who had been here since the summer who had been at the expo, and then others who had come on their own at various points in the last few years. Most of the people who are in our program are from Angola or Democratic Republic of Congo, some from other places in Central Africa.
So what kind of feedback did you get? What did they think of the kinds of foods that you served?
Well, I think everybody really had a wonderful time. We had traditional Thanksgiving food, turkey and all the trimmings. We also had a variety of other dishes. We had fried plantains and a Congolese stew and just a variety of food. So it wasn't just the traditional. And I think that's one of the great things about Thanksgiving is that every group that gathers adds their own ethnic and family traditions to it.
That's terrific. Well, thank you for joining us, Shoshana. Shoshana Hose is with Welcoming the Stranger, and she led a Thanksgiving event for New Mainers. And we have a question for you, Peggy, that just came in. It says, what is your take on using expired molasses? And there's a picture to go with it.
You know, I am not an expert. I want to say this very strongly. I'm not a food safety expert. I tend to think it's sugar. It will last for a long time. If you're not seeing any mold, if you're not seeing some particular sign that it's bad, and if you've kept it, you know, in a dark, somewhat cool place, I have molasses around for a while. My other thought is that then you're going to be baking or cooking with it, and you'll be heating it, so you might destroy much of anything that was in it. All that said, I'm not a doctor. I'm not a food safety expert.
Sick.
If I were feeding a very small child or an elderly person, I might not take the risk. If it were just me, I'd probably think, it's fine.
So I'd probably get myself a still and make rum.
Oh, there you go.
I like
then
that.
Then you kill all the germs.
I do think it depends on when it expired. You know, if it expired in 1998, I'd be hesitant to use it.
I have a sneaking feeling I know who's asking this question, and I think it just expired. I think what she told me was 2018.
Oh, heavens.
Okay,
so,
see, I'm notorious
I wouldn't
for
be
keeping
too worried.
Things long. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just anything that gets heated is good to go for me. But molasses is actually an ingredient in a lot of traditional Maine foods, right? So why is that?
It was the least expensive form of sugar and sweetening for a lot of people.
It's also part of the triangular trade,
exactly.
Unfortunately.
Yeah.
You know,
molasses to rum
staves and what was it?
Rum.
Shingles and staves from Maine
went
south, and sugar produced in the south came back. Often transformed into molasses in Boston for redistribution. But sometimes it was transformed in the Caribbean too. But it was part of that nefarious thing called the triangular trade.
And then it made its way into breads and puddings.
Yeah,
and
because it was
all
cheap.
Kinds of things
and because it lasted.
Right. And it's in brown bread, right?
I
just bought some of that. I was going to actually taste it before today's show. But
an Indian pudding.
An Indian pudding.
And baked beans very often have molasses.
Right. Yes, of course.
Okay. We have a tweet from Lucy. This is for you, Sam. My friend is a server at 4th Street and recently attended a Friendsgiving with the 4th Street line cooks. She says it was the best Thanksgiving food she's ever eaten.
Oh, I'll bet. That must have been great.
So that wasn't something the restaurant did. That was the cooks getting together.
No, I think that
together.
Was on their own. I heard about it after the fact, but that sounds incredible.
That is awesome.
I know the talent of this group, and I know what they're capable of.
And they didn't have you come?
No. They wouldn't want me around for that.
That leads me to ask a question. This business of Friendsgiving, I mean, I thought Thanksgiving was a place where you gathered friends and family and even strangers together. I don't understand this, what do we call them, Gen X or whatever they are,
Gen Z,
need
millennials.
To establish something different.
Go ahead,
Oh,
Peggy.
I was going to say, I think that so often people have family obligations. You're going to your parents or you're hosting your parents or grandparents. It's usually a family event. You might invite a couple of strays, a couple friends who aren't doing that. But I think you don't often get to have it with your group of, 10 or 15 friends.
Lots of diverse people at Thanksgiving.
I mean, I grew up with a family where we always had, you know, if they, we always had, no. We always had several people who either were from another culture and we were introducing to Thanksgiving or weren't, you know, were at loose ends for whatever reason.
Yeah.
But that's still, I mean, for me, the tradition of Friendsgiving, you're still probably not likely to be having all your line cook buddies at your Thanksgiving.
It just strikes me as a really good idea. And it's something that there have been some antecedents for that in Portland. There was a group of chefs who got together and arranged a big multi-course meal for quite a while. I forget what they called themselves. It doesn't matter. But I was going to mention as well that I grew up in a household where my father was a chaplain at universities for most of his career. And quite often there were grad students, mostly foreign students, who had no place to go over the holidays, and they came to Thanksgiving at our house. So we were full of an international community of students at the house. It was great. It was just terrific.
I have to ask, were your parents good chefs too?
My mother was a pretty good cook. She was a Southerner and was deep in the traditions of South Carolina and in Louisiana, where we spent a significant part of my childhood.
The lucky students who got to share that with you. We will go now to Sue calling in Portland. Hi, Sue. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
We have a family tradition of a stuffing that's made with all the ground turkey gizzards, onions, a little bit of celery, lots of garlic. All of that is sautéed in butter, about a pound, for about, I don't know, an hour and a half. And then it gets mixed in with mashed potatoes and... Mm. That's the stuffing, and my brother-in-law Vito made it for years, and his father was an Italian immigrant, and his mother was French-Canadian, and we always wanted to know, is this a French recipe, or is this an Italian recipe? And I've never been able to find it online. I've never seen a recipe like it, but it is so good that my adult children will come over the morning before and have a bowl of it. And it sounds terrible, but it's just delicious. The whole house just smells so good. Anyway, I was wondering if you had any idea as to the origins.
Any guess?
I wouldn't dare to guess. I think it's one of those, you know, we were talking about people coming together from different cultures and amalgamating their food traditions. And that sounds to me like that's what this is. It sounds absolutely delicious. So I would think that the potatoes maybe came from the French side. I mean, the Franco side, not the French in France side. But the rest of it, you know, it does sound wonderful. And I can imagine having a bowl of it for breakfast would be just terrific.
Well, that's great. Thank you for calling, Sue. We'll keep our international theme going here. This is an email from Michelle. My parents immigrated from Galway, Ireland to New England in the 1950s and celebrated all things American, including Thanksgiving. Our Thanksgiving table was filled with all the traditional fixings, from the turkey with stuffing in the bird to pumpkin pie and Indian pudding for dessert. As kids, we loved it. It was the only day we weren't required to eat cabbage and were served white dinner rolls instead of the dense and now, I think, delicious brown bread that is the staple in most Irish households. So thank you for sending that in,
Cindy,
Michelle.
Can we ask about your Thanksgivings
growing up? Oh, talk about international.
Exactly.
So my parents are originally from China. I was born in the U.S., and they don't understand the appeal of turkey because in Chinese food, you don't eat a big hunk of meat and you don't eat dry meat. So to them, it was not appealing. So they would either make a big Chinese feast, which is all good stuff, or they would make duck. Mm. But I would say that when I went to school and everybody would talk about their turkey, I felt like I was missing something.
You know, that's another little aspect of this that's interesting, is that very often people will do turkey, but the ethnic background will come out in the stuffing. And I think it was Amy Tan was describing, author of The Joy Luck Club and many other great books, was discussing putting Chinese sausage in the dressing. And that sounds wonderful
in
to me.
In fact, we've done a sticky rice food with the sausage and vegetables, and that is a great version of stuffing in
our
family. Yeah,
good for the bicentennial cookbook.
Oh, there you go.
Well.
I'll have to chime in. Okay. We have an email from Donna. We have 18 adults, 2 babies, 4 dogs coming to our annual traditional Thanksgiving dinner, and we most enjoy celebrating the number of local ingredients we serve. These include the turkey from North Yarmouth, the squash from Ellsworth, and the applesauce and chutney from the apples in our backyard, to speak of a few. We feel so grateful to have access to so many wonderful foods from Maine. So, Sam, that's your area of expertise. Yeah, that's your cue.
Well, so much of what's available for even a traditional November dinner can come from Maine farms now that it's almost redundant to bring that up again. But my wife makes great applesauce, and quite frequently, and that's just the beginning of the kinds of things that we can add to a
Don't forget the potatoes. That's
Yep.
The
grounding
thing.
She grows our potatoes too, so that it's.
But potatoes from Maine, I mean.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, here's another one. This one, I bet, Peggy, you might have an answer for. Email from Patty in Camden. She is looking for advice on making holiday meals that are also eco-friendly. So shopping local.
Definitely shopping local. There was actually something on National Public Radio this morning where they were trying to figure out the carbon footprint of America for Thanksgiving, and which was not so good. But one of the big suggestions they had for cutting the transportation costs for all the food was that you shop local. So I would definitely say that, tempting as it is for a big feast, especially if you're for the person who was having 18 people and four dogs and several grandchildren, it's very tempting to use disposables. But I just would really argue it's good not to use those, not even napkins. If you have cloth napkins and you can use them, I think that's a good thing to do. And somehow feels like it honors the idea of we're a very wasteful, extravagant nation now. But certainly they did not have that option in the early Thanksgivings. And obviously make stock from your turkey.
Oh, there you go.
Use every part. Exactly.
Maximize. Okay, we will go to Kit now, calling from Belfast. Hi, Kit. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. So I can never figure out which generation I am, Gen X or Millennial. I was born in 1984.
And you the might be in the cusp.
Thing, I think I'm right on the edge. So I wanted to just say that for my friends who were all LGBTQ, a lot of us.
Oops. Kit, you're cutting out. Let's see. Are you still there? Oh, too bad. I think we lost Kit, but I think she wanted to talk about Friendsgiving. And so I'm assuming what she's saying is that for her generation, you know, maybe some folks are in not the most traditional, perhaps most traditional family situations or anything like that. So it is
but
an
does
alternative.
It have to be that? You know, this is what I'm arguing, that Thanksgiving is about being together and giving thanks. It's not about tradition. It's not about being a Norman Rockwell family. It has nothing to do with that. And we get caught up in that image of Thanksgiving. And to me, it destroys the whole meaning of the holiday.
Okay. Well, we're running out of time, so I just wanted to hear from each of you. Is there any special ingredient that you just love to add to something that makes it shine? Any, like, spice or something?
I love cranberries.
Oh, there
They're
you go.
They're so tart. I love tart things. I love rhubarb. I love cranberries. And this is off point, and I'm sorry, but I loved the sign I saw as I was driving to the studio, which was one of those great highway signs that which said, "We are grateful for safe drivers and pie."
Ah, love that. All right, real quick, Nancy.
Sam. Oh, I guess I would have to say cumin. If I put cumin on the turkey, I might even love the turkey.
That's a great ingredient. What about you, Sam?
So my recent discovery is making broths and stocks for soups and sauces in my Instapot. So I filled the Instapot with backs and necks of turkey, and you could use drumsticks, covered them with water, and then did them under pressure for 2 hours, and it's consommé clear, gels up like a reduced stock does, and it's fantastic.
That's terrific. Well, thank you all for joining us. We're out of time. That's Nancy Harmon Jenkins, Peggy Grudinski, and Sam Hayward, and I'm Cindy Hahn. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio. Have a happy Thanksgiving.